A little bit different. I'm going to, the commission has agreed that we will set aside 15 minutes for the small-scale miners at the end of this to have a panel discussion or however they wish to organize their time so that the small-scale miners will come up and use, we will set the clock for 15 minutes rather than calling up individuals. But other than that, we do have other individuals. I think everybody knows the rules. 3 minutes, the buzzer goes off. Finish up your thoughts. If not, you'll start seeing me scowl at you and things like that. So with that, I'll call you up two at a time. Patty Carter and Richard Johnson, please. Good to see you, Patty. And thank you for all the good work you guys do.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Patty Carter, one of the founding directors of the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation. It's a little nonprofit that was created in 2012 to help the Puyallup Fish Hatchery. Every year I pop down here about this time to say hi and to give you an update once again for the opportunity that we've had that's been granted our whole community to breathe new life into this little special hatchery that sits on over 80 acres in the middle of our city. We're currently in our second year partnership with the Puyallup School District, teaching STEM education outside using the hatchery and all of its grounds. What does that mean exactly? It means that the first year was a huge success. So after they analyzed it, they not only want to keep the program, they want to grow the program. So we had 900 students approximately last year, and this year we're going to have about 1,200. And of course, this program is run during the salmon run in Clark's Creek coming back. So the children actually see the salmon spawning, and then they also learn what goes on inside the hatchery. So it's win-win. Pierce Conservation District is one of our partners in this, and they cover one of the learning stations. 2 weeks ago, the school board, Puyallup School Board, asked that their communication director come out and follow these kids because it's becoming quite well known. So they took pictures and did a report, and I passed that out to all of you. So when you have spare time, you might enjoy looking at the pictures and reading about that. It's also up on their Facebook page. Going forward, we're looking at another partnership with maybe a local college to bring internship-type students to do some of the training at the stations that we have. And we think it'd be wonderful to have college students with fourth grade students, and what they would get out of the program would be wonderful too. So we're working on that too. The Salmon Homecoming, another huge success. Ron was asking about it. We think there was over 1,200 local people. We don't sell anything there. It's not like Issaquah's, even though theirs is wonderful. We teach things there. We have a lot of vendors that show children all sorts of things about watershed and fish and things like that. And then we have guided tours with fish biologists up to the creek to explain things to, with live music and food, of course. It's been 5 years. I come down every year, and I think you're not tired of me yet. And they're very busy fulfilling years. All of this has been done by volunteers and donations from our end of it. The staff at the hatchery is wonderful, very helpful. Jim Jenkins is a pro. Unless you don't know that already, I'll tell you. He's very professional. He's open to new ideas all the time. And, of course, I have to mention every single year that none of this would have been possible without Ron Warren and Jim Scott at the time in 2012. They looked at each other after we, you know, hammered away with several of us, and they said, okay, give him a shot. Along the way, there's another special person I have to mention quickly. We wouldn't be here today where we're at with these students. His knowledge, years of experience regarding hatcheries, fish, salmon, science, biology, we've come to call him Mr. Google. It's Richard Johnson. He's our vice president of our foundation, and he's a wonderful asset to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take the opportunity to say thank you for doing this. I've seen a little bit of this in other areas, and when you see these youngsters have their light bulbs turn on matters of the natural environment and salmon runs and all the rest, that carries with them for, for years and years, through their whole life, really. But anyway, appreciate very much you guys doing this.
Vacation days. We had three classes or 3 days full classes this week, yesterday even. And when you see them leave, I mean, it's there's nothing like it. You can't even explain that feeling and what they've learned.
Really appreciate the work you're doing. I was involved with Salmon Fest in Leavenworth for many years, and it's very rewarding. Something you can look forward to is people that were through the process when they were in grade school that visited the hatchery and went to Salmon Fest are now bringing their families and their youngsters to Salmon Fest. It's one a tremendous outreach program and educational, and thanks for the work you people do. It's very rewarding.
Richard? I was working for the Muckleshoot tribe at the White River Fish Hatchery. I was the fish biologist there. I retired in 2013. I live two blocks from the Puyallup Hatchery. So I let Patty know that I was retired now, and I was available and willing to contribute some of my expertise. And we had coffee downtown one day, and she told me her vision for the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation, and I bought in, and next thing you know, I'm there. And so I found my niche right away was being the tour director. So I borrowed the volunteer manual that Friends of Issaquah Salmon Hatchery had put together. They put together a really nice one. They said I could use it and plagiarize it, so I borrowed it and put one together for us. And at first, while we were getting our name out there, we might get one request a month for a tour. Now we're getting requests like weekly. We bring people from preschool through college, senior citizens. We try to accommodate everybody who contacts us. And with our limited volunteer base, it is difficult at times, but we're working on expanding our volunteer base, and so we usually don't have to turn people away. We've got a good run of coho back in Clark's Creek right now, which was perfect for our fourth graders to see. Their third and fourth graders are a wonderful age for teaching. They still believe that adults know something, so which it helps a lot. So before I got into fisheries, I was looking for a job, and I was working at the Ballard Locks as a park ranger, so I led a lot of tours there. And I knew third and fourth graders were the creme de la creme. So we're very, very happy that this program has been such a success.
I just want to add, his wife is really happy too, because I keep him really occupied with the hatchery.
Exactly.
And working with your local higher education, your local college, yeah, there's a lot of win-wins and all of that. So. Yeah, I know I speak for all of us.
Thanks
for what you do, and you keep well done, keep doing it. And we'll look forward to you don't have to come every year. You can come before that.
Well, we're busy, you know. It's like,
I know.
We're doing stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thank you. So Don Wallace and Sean, please.
Hi, everybody. Morning. Some of you may remember me from Port Angeles. I'm here to talk about the American Dipper again and trying to get you guys to stop the banding of the American Dipper. I got an email from Joe Buchanan. It was very nice, very polite. Basically, all it really says is nothing other than asking me to basically go away. And everything is fine with the American Dipper, but it's not. the stuff that you're getting here, the cards I had made up just for you folks. As you notice, there's a salmon egg on one side and a fingerling on the other. But the Smithsonian, when they came to Washington State in the Pacific Northwest, they came here to just be a part of the Elwha Dam removal. This study was hijacked from Fish and Wildlife. Jim Kaiser, I don't know if any of you know him, he's no longer with Fish and Wildlife. I believe he left right after the Smithsonian came to town because they took his study about the invertebrates and made it about the Dipper. They banded 246 of them, and it's just not healthy. I can go on and on about it, but I want to just at this point, at this time, I'm going to Chris Tundra, who headed up the Smithsonian study, he sicked the your Fish and Wildlife Police on me. He had them contact me because he felt I was being threatening towards him, which wasn't the case. When your officer called me, it was very tense at the beginning of our phone conversation. He was aggressive and I was defensive because I had no idea where he was coming from. And it all evolved on a Facebook comment on a site that I have, Olympic Dipper Research. But after over an hour and a half of us talking together, he realized that I was just a person that was very passionate about these birds and what I'm doing and trying to protect them from wildlife biologists. Because this study did nothing. It proved no points. They came up with a lot of facts that are based on no anything. I mean, it was all about the stable isotopes and that such thing. I can go into details, but the point I'm trying to make in this first time we talk here is that if you guys spend the time with me, you got my contact information, we could spend hours talking about this, and I'm certain when I'm done that you'll be convinced that there's no need to ever ban an American Dipper again. So,
thank you.
I'll be here all day.
Barbara?
Yeah. So I noticed on the first off, very nice materials.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you for that. I notice on this email from Mr. Buchanan that it says that the Smithsonian study is completed.
It is complete.
And to my knowledge, there are no studies in Washington that involve banding.
Not at this moment.
So I'm asking specifically, are you asking us to say, okay, don't ever band again? Take the
yes.
bands off the birds.
No, you can't.
And let me just finish one more thing.
Excuse me.
If there are studies of this type, I'm not a biologist, are there alternatives to banding that would provide the scientists with the information that they need?
Yes.
Okay.
Number one is just close observation. Because what they're trying to prove was that they're healthier with salmon. Logic just tells you that. Yes, of course it is. They don't need to capture and do this to do it. The studies, it is to stop it. I mean, you guys do have the power to do that within the state. I've been fighting nationally with the bird banding laboratory for years on this. This is something that's not new with me. I've been going at this since the study 2012 with these people. But it doesn't mean they won't band again. And I mean, it doesn't mean that just because there's no studies of the Dipper going on doesn't mean that some other study might include them. I think they just need to be excluded just because of the danger of where they live.
So can I just ask a follow-up?
So
if we aren't banding now, it seems to me that asking that we have a decision that we will never band again brings into a lot of other issues, which is
expanding Burge generally?
That's why it's a battle, and that's why this would be groundbreaking effort on your guys' part, because it does bring in that question about banding other birds. The American dipper is unique in that it lives in water. It lives in the fast-moving streams, rivers. That's their whole life. I've watched them fall and get caught up, the band get caught up on a twig and fall face first into the water and not, you know, just fighting to get free. When I saw this as a photographer, I didn't take a picture. I jumped up and ran to try to save it. It got free before I got to it, but it would have drowned. But it just... If you start thinking, if you think about standing in a creek that's swift water and you've got bands on your legs that are, to you, at least 3 inches wide, and you've got a pair of them on each leg, and you're feeling that force against you, that's the same thing with them. These bands go up and down. I have a video here that I'll gladly share with anybody during your breaks or whatever that... I call moving bands. It's on YouTube as well, that demonstrates this absolute fact of how the bands do not stay just, they're not, I mean, they don't just hang there. Because they're in water, they're going up and down, up and down, up and down. There isn't flesh on the legs, but there is a bit of skin, and there is some tissue, and there is muscle at the joints. I've witnessed one that I've talked about here that had died. I mean, she almost made it through to finishing her nest, but it got halfway done and she disappeared.
Are there any other questions?
No.
But. Okay. Thank you, Don.
Okay. Thank you.
Sean, good to see you.
Good morning. Sean Cantrell, Northwest Regional Director for Defenders of Wildlife. I want to touch briefly on three topics. To your surprise, none of them will involve wolves. Number one, the draft marketing plan that you're having a presentation on today. I am intrigued by it. I think it's a great idea. I have concerns, and they may be addressed during the presentation, but I would urge you to all listen and look at it and see, as you're trying to boost outdoor recreation, which is the purpose, it seems to be almost exclusively focused on a goal of increasing or related to hunters and fishers, anglers and hunters, which is a laudable goal, but it leaves out a major segment of dealing with watchable wildlife or just the diversity program in general and finding support for that. So I would encourage you to listen carefully, ask questions, and hopefully encourage changes as it goes from draft to final in that regard. A second item is around orca. You may be aware that a few weeks ago, the governor had expressed significant concerns about the plight of the current state of orca in the state. And your department here, as well as some of the other state agencies, are looking at bringing together some kind of task force to take some action. I would encourage you as a commission to look at what specific actions can be done by the commission in the very near term. I mean, this is a crisis, as has been identified, and I think your staff is definitely very well engaged in this, but I think that there are opportunities and needs, and they won't be easy, but I think that as a commission, you should be looking at this and asking for recommendations from staff of what the commission needs to do in order to try to stem the loss of orca. And then the third item I wanted to touch base on briefly is I spent the last 2 days out in Ponderay County, which was just a fabulous time. I was talking with local folks out there, the local county officials, as well as the Kalispell tribe, talking about bears and trying to reduce conflict and interactions with, you know, unfortunate interactions between humans and bears. And so it dealt a lot with addressing attractants, trying to secure garbage and other attractants. But also the topic came up multiple times around misidentification between grizzly bears and black bears. And I learned, and again, I haven't researched it, so your staff could probably address it better, but the fact that in Washington State, if you get a bear tag, you don't have to demonstrate that you can tell the difference between a black bear and a grizzly bear. And we do have grizzly bears, particularly in Northeast Washington, and that, you know, the state of Wyoming, the progressive bastion of Wyoming, requires hunters with a bear tag to take a bear identification course in order to get that tag. And I would encourage the commission to look at whether or not that is something that should be required to say. If you're going to go out and go bear hunting, you should be able to tell the difference if what you're pointing your gun at and pulling the trigger is an endangered species or the more plentiful black bear. So those are my three thoughts, and I'm happy to talk about wolves anytime you want to ask questions. Thanks.
You always bring forth good points, Sean. Thank you. Questions? No, but we will take those under advisement. That's good. Thank you. And before we get to, oh, no, we have two more. Robert and Ron, please.
I don't know. It's not on there. You want to put it on?
Would you mind if Ron went first? Like, see if I can get my PowerPoint.
I'm sorry, if Ron went first?
Could Ron go first?
You want to go first?
I only need like 6 hours. Okay. So, thank you today, commissioners, director, deputy director, for having this time here that we can talk about issues we have on the table. I'm Ron Garner, president of Puget Sound Anglers, largest fishing club in Washington State. 16 chapters statewide. I'd like to congratulate Mr. Don McIsaac as a new commissioner and the reinstatement of Commissioner Carpenter. So I think our fisheries stand a better chance having this kind of background on the staff, and I'm looking forward to working with all of you again. I sent out a letter late last night to the director and to the commission, and it's on crab issues. You might or might not know, some of us have been advisors, shellfish advisors, for 15 years on shrimp and crab, and we helped put together the crab management policy for the Puget Sound and the shrimp management policy for the Puget Sound. It was a very uncomfortable time. We had picketers out here. I remember heading to Westport and had my boat on my truck, and I had to end up parking about 3 miles that way and running here to get here because there's no place to park a truck in a big boat. So anyway, fast forwarding, what's happening right now is some of the tribes have come forward and said that we are over harvesting. And so the catch record card, the department agreed to a pilot program to go out and check in July to see how our crab fishery was going. From what I can see, what came back, the results were, if anything, when we our management of our crab versus the tribal crab, we were over-reporting, if anything, on our program. So this shows that what we're doing is working correctly. Now, it's come back again that they want the tribes, a couple of the tribes, want us to shut down our winter fishery. Now, when we set this policy up, the crab policy, we fish first, meaning the recreationals, and in the end, the commercials get to go. And this was very unpleasant, but this is how it ended up. So right now, we have an agreed signed-to plan of 1.25 million pounds of crab per side. We are 200,000 pounds shy of getting there. Now, if we finish our winter fishery, we'll get our 30,000, and the commercials will get their 170,000, roughly. I don't think it's fair because the tribes are asking us once again to shut down this fishery, and it's not a conservation issue. They quit fishing earlier, and now they want to play catch-up, and they want us to shut our fishery down so they can go and don't want us on the water. We've fished side-by-side before. At Edmonds last year, they came in and corked us with gill nets while we were fishing for coho this year. We still fish together. So it can be done, but I would like to make sure that we don't back down and shut down this fishery. It's unfair to the commercials, and it's unfair to our policy. This policy was a tough policy, and it took a lot of time and effort. And you remember, Commissioner Carpenter, how tough this was. And I think this is something that needs to be adhered to. There's a lot of talking points of why this is a bad idea. Mainly, it's a non-conservation idea. But what it sets up is, at what point do we get dictated by the tribes over any fishery? And we are working right now with three of the northern tribes trying to bring us all together, the Lummies, the Tulalips, and the Upper Skagits, as well as some of the commercials. And we want to fix our fisheries for the better for all of us, and having two or three little entities chipping and screwing the whole ball game up isn't helping. So I'd like to thank you for your time today, but if you could read the points on here, I would say definitely no to any other deal. We have a signed management plan. Let it ride. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan. Any questions? Yeah.
I guess I'd address this to the director or Ron. This was brought to my attention yesterday. Are you in a position to give us, share with us your thoughts on this, where it is now, or what is your strategy for addressing this, I guess, over the short term?
Mr. Chairman, do you want that now? I think we could add that to the director's report, and Ron could give a...
That'd be fine, yeah.
And this is being fast-tracked, by the way. This could all be done by Monday. We could be shut down if this agreement goes through.
Mr. Chairman... And let me expose all of my ignorance on Puget Sound crab issues. The winter sport season that you're speaking of, when does that occur? Is it set to occur and being requested to be closed, or is it not set? And if it, and what does winter season mean in terms of calendar?
Okay, what we start in July and we end beginning of September, and as quick as they can figure out where they are, we reopen for recs in September, the end of September or early October, and that's when the commercials time, the non-tribal commercials time is in October, or maybe in September, depending on how this works out. But that is their time to go fishing, and stopping this is not letting them fulfill what our agreement was. And that's one of the issues I have is, it was a tough fishery, but it's not fair to them, and it's not fair to finish out. If it's not a conservation issue, if it is, then we agree to a decrease in quota across the board. But this isn't what this is about. This is about the tribes quit fishing. I can fill you in a lot more detail if you would like on, you know, at a different time, but I have a lot of information over this. A lot of it's in the talking points on the second letter. I sent the first letter. You have the first letter that was sent out June 23rd. Second letter names off more points again of what is going on and why this is not a good idea, because this is going to just go right in. When we've done negotiations, being nice has not ever really gotten us anywhere. Standing the grounds, when Rich Childers was there, he wouldn't give this any merit. And I think, in all reality, you should probably go to Shellfish Manager Bob Sizemore and talk to him about this, because he's pretty up to date on this, but he has that data, too, and I think he's here today.
Commissioner Keough.
Thank you, Rob, for bringing this to the commission's attention. I also received word from Brian Allenson, the president of the Puget Sound Crab Association, and he alerted me to the situation. I guess, and I understand that, you know, we'll get a director's report or some sort of response. You know, if there is a decision ultimately to kind of stand down for a period of time, I guess personally I would like to know, and I'm sure everybody else would like to know, what criteria will we use to start up the fishery? Because, you know, this is a very, of course, as the fall months and winter approaches, weather becomes more and more of a challenge. And I don't think it would be acceptable outcome for anybody if the state were to leave some crab unharvested. So this is I'm concerned about this. But I would like to, you know, speak and learn more about the issue and in particular the criteria that will be used to reinitiate a fishery if there is any period of time where we're standing down. So thank you, Ron.
Yeah, and they were the ones that contacted me to tell me what was happening. And in the beginning, we were adversaries, but we've since become friends, I guess you would say, and we've also worked with other boards such as the Northwest Straits Foundation together. We've actually done quite a bit of good things together. So, you know, I think it should be fair to them. We have a small amount left, but the overall policy was to let them fish later, and I think they should be allowed to do that in the spirit of the policy.
And if I just may follow up, I agree with you. I think the department's or the commission's policy is assumes that that the commercial folks can prosecute their fishery and get their quota. If that's not the case, then I think the policy needs to be reexamined. So, just
thank you.
Thanks, Ron. I'm sorry. Yes.
There again, since we're going to kick it down the road a little bit till the director's report, till we get the department side of this, if he ends up with some real heartburn with something he said, could he come back up?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You good with that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He won't be shy.
I have thick skin.
Well, but it's just the formality of it.
Yeah.
So.
Sure. You're going to hang around anyhow, Front.
Yeah, I have a panel this afternoon. Right. I have one other issue to bring up a little bit later on hatchery reform.
Okay, so stand ready. And Robert.
Thank you. You should have all these slides in a handout, five-page handout. So I got 3 minutes. I'll try to get through them. I'm Robert Sudar. I'm a commercial advisor from the Columbia River. I've been involved in all the working groups, and I've been an advisor for about 30 years. So the first one is a review of our Columbia River fishery. This shows our openings over the last 5 years. This year we didn't get any spring opening at all per the policy. That results in no public access to fish other than through the recreational fishery. None of these publicly funded spring Chinook in the Columbia or the Willamette or the Kalama or the Cowlitz or the Lewis get to market when we don't have a fishery in the main stem. In the summer season, we got no openings again this year also. This is a strong run of hatchery and wild fish. We've had the smallest component of the take. The recreational fishery can't catch the fish that we don't catch at this time. There was no good reason for us to not have an opening. Those two fisheries together, about one opening in the spring and two in the summer, could have put another $360,000 to $400,000 into the lower river communities based on prices.
Now, the numbers you have up there, I'm not following. I mean, like, in 2017, you have zero, and then 2016, you have six. I mean, what do those numbers represent?
Okay, those are the openings that we had in the river between March and the middle of June. So in 2013, we had four openings. In 14, we had five. In 15, we had eight. In 16, we had six. And then the Chinook are the numbers of fish we caught in each of those. And then the deliveries are the maximum deliveries on any given opening that we had. And then in this year, we had no openings. We were not allowed any per the policy. And it's the same data on the summer season. Yeah. I wish I had a pointer. I couldn't find it today. I'm sorry.
So is this main stem and safe areas?
No, this is main stem only.
Okay.
So if you want, for the select areas, they did have a good season in the spring in the select areas, but they had 150 openings to catch those. 150 individual openings in order to catch 11,000 fish. You know, and that spread from February through the middle of June or late June. Now, that's a lot of time to catch not that many fish. So there was about $1.5 million there, but in those couple openings I talked about, we could have caught 25% of that in just three or four openings in the main stem. And not all the fishermen in the fleet can access the select areas. And I can't buy there because I'm not an Oregon buyer. I'm a Washington buyer. And we've gone backwards in select areas in Washington. We haven't progressed there at all. So that's the point. The next page shows our fall fisheries and similar data in the same kind of organization. We have two seasons, an August fishery and a late fall fishery in September and October. Now, the limitation this year was based on steelhead. It wasn't the policy that limited us. But the bottom line is that as we lose impacts, our opportunity to fish gets smaller and smaller. But the policy did eliminate our coho fishery, our 6-inch coho fishery, which was excellent for removing late hatchery fish off the river. The managers called it a free fishery because there's such a high mark rate in that. And we had no tangle net fisheries the last 2 years either. The third slide is the long sheet of paper you might have had. And this is just comparing recreational opportunity in 2012 before the policy and 2017 with the policy in its present condition. And if you look at that, the message was supposed to be sport priority. Basically, they were getting just as many days in 2012 when we had a viable mainstem fishery as they did this year when we had almost no mainstem fishery. It's not a function of the allocation of the runs. It's a function of the actual run versus the predicted run, the river conditions, the temperature, all sorts of other factors. It's not a matter of trying to remove allocation from one group and give it to the other and think that you're going to create a lot better fishery for one. This is pre and post policy, similar run size except for spring, but angler trips have gone down. That's the reality of what you're not accomplishing with this policy, which is crushing our industry. The last two slides are just looking at when we fish this year compared to passage of steelhead. There have been some comments that in the observation program we didn't handle very many steelhead because there weren't very many in the river, and that's just not accurate. It was pretty typical, similar numbers. Matter of fact, at some points there were more steelhead in the river than there were chinook at the early part of our fishery. And the last slide gives 10-year average information the same way, and the arrows indicate when we were fishing along that timeline. So my message is that we keep looking at this policy. I keep hearing conversations about how it's conservation. There's no conservation. It's strictly shifting allocation. There are no ESA fish that are being saved intentionally via this policy. It's crushing our commercial fishery. It's crushing my business. It's frustrating to the markets I sell to because Chinook are the primary market fish. And this was a bad year for getting Chinook in the marketplace. And I don't know how else to say it, but this policy is not working for us. It's not working. It's not helping the resource. It's not gaining angler trips. It's not increasing sport priority. It's doing none of that.
Thank you, Robert. Yes, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on your testimony regarding spring Chinook in these terminal areas, these safe areas. You mentioned that there has not been success in the Washington safe areas. Right. And again, as a new person here, I'm not completely aware of the Columbia River policy, but if you could, what was the original objective for Washington safe areas for spring Chinook that was intended to occur as we move toward 2017? And could you state again, when you say there was nothing there, what that means? Does that mean the season was closed, or there was just no fish there, or what?
Okay, well, the select areas in general were supposed to be a supplement to the mainstem fishery. They were never intended to replace the mainstem fishery. The policy indicated an expansion of the select areas to take the place of what we would be losing in the mainstem. There have been some increases in releases in Oregon. In Washington, we've basically eliminated the one select area in the spring that we have, which is deep river. We aren't releasing fish anymore. We've cut back on coho, and now I think NIMS is requiring us to switch the hatcheries to switch to late coho releases. So basically, we are releasing fewer fish in the one Washington select area than we were before the policy. And the spring planting has been eliminated because they just don't come back. It's not successful. I think they had under 100 fish caught there this year, on the last year that they had anything coming back. They tried to establish something in Cathlamet Channel. It's been unsuccessful. They've had no recoveries of those fish after 2 years. It's there's just nothing going on there. We don't have a good spot on the Washington side that compares to a place like Young's Bay in Oregon. And it doesn't. And financially, I could give you the numbers. We made as much money in 7 days on the mainstem this fall for our industry as the select areas produced in the fall in 150 days there. In 150 days of openings, 150 openings, let me put it that way. There's no money to be made there.
Yeah, mine is a request for staff listening to Robert's testimony. If you have 150 openings, I imagine that means that there are many, many more trips per that amount of fish. And so I would like an economic analysis of that. It seems to me as we're reviewing this policy, and we look at the economics, and it seems like that needs to go into the economics of the commercial fishery. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much, Jim. Let me just eject the slide here, and I'll be out of your hair for this one.
So I have William Brown representing the small-scale miners, and as we agreed, you will have 15 minutes to present in any manner or fashion you wish to. So you want to come up and kick it off, William? And then once you're set up, ready to go, then the... Oh, so you're it?
I'm the only one.
Okay, we were under the that we thought you were going to have a...
My partners were actually supposed to be here with me, but one of them had to deal with his children. He had to be they had school today, and his wife was in Oregon dealing with a family matter, so he wasn't able to come. And the other member, Justin Carr, was also unable to make it due to business that he had to attend to today. So I was the only one left to do this.
All right. So do you, I think we'll, given that, we'll cut down the 15 minutes?
Actually, it's just I want to go over, I gave a handout. So basically what it is just a statement from the small scale.
Okay, fine. Then take her away.
All right. Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'd like to start out that my name is William Brown. I am a small scale miner. And we had a case litigated against WDFW through the Beatty versus WDFW case, which you have a handout of the summary of the case. And what we want to do today is go over the rulemakings and how it was the least burdensome changes that were needed to be made or chosen to be made. So the Thurston County Superior Court had reviewed the rulemaking, and the governing of small-scale mining concluded that the commission made two mistakes. First, the commission did not make the finding whether the rules were the least burdensome in the matter. And number two, the commission did not make the finding whether the rules imposed more than minor cost on small businesses, such that small business and environmental impact statements should be prepared. And we'd like to talk about those issues one by one. But first, I want to remind the commission that as a department had to assemble its administrative records for the Superior Court, it became clear that many of the restrictions imposed by the staff had no basis at all. One of the department's staff actually wrote, "This is going to be the biggest piece of crap we ever put together." This was documented. And recognized that there were legitimate concerns as to whether imposing the work window restrictions were really that important to fish, to protect the fish. Whether imposing work windows restrictions were really that important. Independent fishery experts have testified that the prospects that miners will actually hit salmon or steelhead reds are utterly insignificant. We don't like to go into the areas where salmon like to spawn or ESA fish will spawn. They like loose gravels. We're more into the compact areas that cannot be spawned into. Forest-wide studies of mining cannot show any significant impact on fish populations whatsoever. A perfect example would be the Peshastin Creek system. Peshastin Creek was literally destroyed by the construction of Highway 97. And there's a report that shows that Peshastin above Camas Creek cannot support any salmonoid life at any stage. The least restrictive alternative issues, the law requires that before regulated the miners, is you state in detail the general goals and specific objectives of the Hydraulic Act, and then determine consideration or determine considering all the alternatives and the cost and benefits of each alternative, whether the rules being adopted is the least burdensome alternative for those required to comply with that will achieve the general goals of the specific objectives. Now, back in August, staff told you that they had previously considered four general alternatives during the 2014 proceedings, but had not explicitly determined what the fourth was, the least restrictive alternative. He claimed that if you didn't make the finding now, you would have to start rulemaking all over again. But there is no reason to reject the use of the least restrictive alternatives now, because you have reopened the rulemaking on October 4th of this year, and while the CR 101 staff has filed makes reference to the purpose of changing the Salton River work windows. The notice also says that you intend to adjust authorized work times generally based on the best available science. And it is clear now that the best available sciences show less restrictive alternatives are available. Now, back on August 4th, the staff member did not explain any of the alternatives you really had to regulate, instead lumping all the rules together in an all-or-nothing package. But you can, should exercise your discretion on a stream-by-stream basis, just as you proposed to do for the Salton River. The Salton River had a very long dredging window up there, and now we've got claims up there that are absolutely unworkable because of the new fish ladder and the spawning fish in that area. We had a site inspection with a biologist up there a couple of weeks ago, and on a claim that has never had any of the ESA-listed fish spawning in there before, now are in there, and they're literally spawning in our tailings from our dredges because that material has been loosened up by us, and now it's being used. We actually witnessed 12 fish in one tailing pile spawning on that weekend. Now, since you've enacted all these work windows, we now have the department's permit writers figured that the most conflict between the miners and fish, because the miners are looking in different gravels, as I had mentioned, we don't like those soft gravels that they're spawning in. We prefer the packed materials. Boulders, we like to get in behind the boulders because it's a natural ripple area. It's a catch area. But it's also the areas where trout, bullhead trout, steelhead may spawn in. So we don't go in there during those spawning seasons. We already recognize that. So the permit writers have also written permits to say just keep out of the pocket gravels, which we do. We do that already based off of our golden fish pamphlet that's written. We have those work windows. We abide by them on a religious basis. And if we want to work outside the windows, we then go in and apply for a permit. We have to do sites inspections. And then if the permit's issued, we have areas that are legitimately workable for us and not in endangering any fish. The rules also shut down many stream reaches where the flows are just too fast for fish to use. And there are creeks out there, for example, Cayeta Creek, right off the Carbon River. It's open year-round. There's trout in there, but yet it's open for dredging year-round. You get into a creek such as Slate Creek, which is above Canyon Creek, and there's a 150-foot waterfall. But we have a limited work window on that one. And the work windows do not work because the timing zone in that, you can't access our claims because of the snow levels. We get 30 to 45 days a year to work that, and we have to have a permit to work those windows. And there's no ESA fish there. Myself, I've requested year-round permit on a Peshastin Creek. We have several claims up there that we are able to work on. The biologist did a site inspection, and I received my permit to work outside the work window. Now, that work permit is only going to give me maybe an extra 30 days of work time because, number one, during the fall or springtime when the runoff is, the water's too high, too fast, too cloudy, you can't see nothing, and it's too dangerous. And then come November, you can't access the claim because of snowfall. So here we get a work window of 6 months that's reduced down to one. Now, small business impact issues that we're noticing, we have actually lost one mining supply store already this year. Prospectors Plus out of Gold Bar, Washington, is out of business. And we have several others, one down in Packwood, Packwood Prospectors. They're on a limited schedule. They go from late spring to early fall, and then they shut down. We have a new store up in Bremerton, Washington, which is West Coast Mining Supply, and it is failing because of the restrictions on timing, the timing windows and what they can do. People are afraid to come in and buy equipment. small-scale miners invest a lot of time and a lot of money into what they're doing. I myself have invested over $10,000 over the last 7 years in equipment to work, and then I'm limited to what I can get in the water, when I can do it, so forth. We are not supporting the communities that where our dredging is allowed. Our claims are in the higher upper reaches, Cascades. We spend money at the stores, gas stations, hotels, whatever the case may be. On an average, I spend $250 a trip just to go. Whether I make my money back in gold, you never know. But $250 minimum fee a trip, and then I have to fuel up as I'm leaving to get home. And so that's business I'm taking away from the communities in which we are near. We go through Cle Elum every single day that we go when we come back from our mining trips, and we're not even spending money in there. We're actually taking extra fuel with us just to get home. So there is supposed to be, we're requesting that small business impact statements be done because of the fact that the potential of losing 0.3% or $100 is whichever is greater, that the miners are involved. They could lose hours of work with these work windows, and those hours equate to money. We have members out there that are literally retired military, retired personnel that have their own claims out there, and they're out there trying to supplement their Social Security or retirement income with the gold that they get. And when they are not allowed to work, that's lost money for them. I mean, each one of our miners are considered to be a sole proprietor. We're out there to make money. We're not out there recreational. I do more work mining physically in 4.5 hours than I do in a full 40-hour week at my full-time job. And that money that I've invested is to better my situation for when I do retire. I'm 54 years old. I've got 10 years to go, and then I'm done working. I plan on becoming a full-time miner and leave it at that, and try to supplement what I should be getting. So, in conclusion, we'd like you to consider the rules, figure out which is going to be the most less restrictive alternatives on us. We are constantly abiding by these rules. We do everything we can to work with WDFW. I have actually been inspected twice this year, and that's the only time I've been inspected in the entire 7 years that I've been doing this on a full-time basis. And the first thing that they asked us when we come in, number one, I'd like to check your equipment out. I want to make sure you're within the guidelines of your equipment. Not a problem. Checked on our refueling. Great. Where our refueling station is off the creek, we take our dredge out of the water, we refuel. Now, the backfilling of the holes. We've got some out there that we've actually come across where the holes aren't backfilled. We go out there and do it. We police our own. I'm members of many, many different mining associations in the state. And we're all working together to obtain the same goal. We don't want to harm salmon. We have never harmed a salmon. We don't show any salmon. We have no documentation of any fish kills through a dredge. So, again, we'd like to see that the staff consider those rules, whether the less restrictive alternatives are available, particularly in the areas of our work windows. We are really hampered by those work windows. And if there's anything I can help you with, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, William. You laid out your points very clearly. Yes.
So, as I understand what you're saying, less restrictive would mean doing away with work windows.
Not necessarily doing away with them, but some of the work windows on the streams that we have our claims on are outside of what we can do because of weather. For example, the Peshastin area. We have a dredge window from August 1st through February 28th. That's 6 months out of the year. But weather conditions permit us to only get in there 2 to 3 months out of the year.
I would think this is really more of a staff concern than a commission concern. This is the least restrictive alternative to allow the pamphlet in most streams, and then in those streams that are deemed high risk, to put in work windows. And what I'm hearing you say is you disagree with where some of those work windows are. I don't see that as a commission issue.
Well, the Salton River is the big one right now because of the fact that, number one, when they built the Comeback Dam up there, they were told that they had to put a fish ladder in down at the diversion dam, which they did. And then once the diversion dam fish ladder was completed, now there's all these fish up there. We have a miner up there that actually owns six claims in that area, and not one of those claims he can work because of the work window now. Went from this big of an area to this big of an area. And it wasn't until just recently that biologists were going up, doing site inspections, showing them where the areas that they'd like to see them stay out of, so on and so forth like that. I have no problem personally with the work windows. I like them. I think they're great. But I think that the timings on those is off. I think that some of the work windows should be adjusted to better access for us. And we do understand that ESA-listed species are important. And, but some of those creeks that are listed as small work windows, there are no such species on those streams.
Thank you. I think we've heard you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your time, Chair.